From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Coming up on the show today, we'll talk with filmmaker Keith McWhorter. His powerful documentary, Milwaukee 53206, tackles the subject of mass incarceration through the lens of families it affects.
Then noted cinematographer Kirsten Johnson reflects on the power of the camera.
You know, with a long lens, you can look deep into someone's eyes in a close-up in a way that you would have to be, you know, sort of standing right up next to them to do in person.
Later, a documentary gives new insights into a Milwaukee native, the late war correspondent Dickie Chappelle, and how she went about her work.
She didn't care what the government said or what maybe another reporter was doing. Her goal was to tell the truth. Certainly all journalists should do that. But she really went after those personal stories of soldiers.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. Good morning. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. In an eight-month series, WUWM looked closely at the issues surrounding mass incarceration of African-American men in Milwaukee. The problem affects the community at large, but probably nowhere more so than the people who live in one Milwaukee zip code.
Milwaukee 53206, A Community Serves Time, is a powerful documentary by a man with no previous connection to the city. Keith McWhorter's film received its world premiere in June at the Oriental Theater, and he joined us then. Keith, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Your film, Milwaukee 53206, premiered here in Milwaukee, and it was so powerful. I was so happy to be able to be a part of the talkback and the excitement of it. It filled the Oriental Theater. Let's back up a little bit before you actually even brought a camera into Milwaukee. What was it about these stories that you wanted to do a film about? I mean, did you start knowing what you wanted to do?
Well, no. I was told that, you know, Transform Pictures brought me in and said, they said, we want to do a film about mass incarceration. And they gave me some of their ideas and said, you know, what do you feel about the subject matter? And I gave them my feelings, and we knew it was an area we can move together with to tell this story. And so, you know, it was discovered that 53206 is the most incarcerated zip code in America. And so we said, well, let's start there. Let's go there and find the stories to tell this story about mass incarceration.
And we're talking about mass incarceration of black men in America.
That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
I mean, if people in general, but we focus on black men just because 53206 is a predominantly black community.
Right. So you came here. What did you find? I mean, how did you decide how to approach this subject?
It was daunting, to tell you the truth. Like, you know, when someone says we want to do the original thought was make a half hour film about mass incarceration, which is this enormous issue that has all sorts of tentacles on it, right? And so I felt overwhelmed, quite honestly. And I didn't sleep some nights trying to figure out, like, how am I going to enter this story? And so I just started coming to Milwaukee and talking to people. And I felt, you know, I couldn't do it in New York. I couldn't make phone calls or things. So I had to come physically here and just walk around, meet people. You know, I started in the nonprofit sectors and just started talking and listening. And I realized that the angle I want to take into this story is through families. And that story has not been told about what it's like for the families to live with incarceration.
So the three people that became the focus of the film, you met simply by coming here and asking questions?
Yeah. I mean, I spoke with I actually came to you guys. I came here and I talked to some of your reporters, and you guys had did a story on Beverly Walker, and I heard that story before coming in. I was fascinated by the fact that, you know, her husband, who's been incarcerated for 20 years at that time, sat in his cell and clipped coupons and sent the coupons home to his family so they could save money, because he felt that he had to contribute to the household somehow, some way. And I thought that was a very interesting story. So when I came here, and they're like, oh yeah, we have her. We know her. We have her contact information. I was like, oh, that's wonderful. I'd love to have a conversation with her. And so we met, and you know, we talked. And when we talked, Baron, her husband, called from Fox Lake Prison, and I had to have a conversation with him as well. And it seemed like there's something that we could work together on. They had a story, and you know, they are a pair, and they have a beautiful family, and it seemed like we could explore that. And so we explored it. I mean, anytime you start working with the stories, there's a dating process. You know, you have to get to know each other, trust each other, see if this will work. They need to know if you will work with them, and vice versa. So that dating process with the family was successful, and so we moved forward.
Was there any fear on your part as a filmmaker that it's kind of the anthropological fear, you know, the minute you enter the village, you change the village? Were you worried that you weren't going to get a true representation of who these people were, that it was going to be gussied up for the camera?
That's what I look for during the dating process, really, to see, are these people for real or is it a show? And you know right away what's going on. Having done it for, you know, a number of years now. With the stories that we followed, you know, there's a sincerity to each of them. And you just know what that is when you see it.
Yeah. Were you surprised by the level of enthusiasm and just energy at the showing at the Oriental? I mean, it was pretty amazing, the energy that was flowing in that room.
Never would have guessed. Never would have imagined. And it was so... I felt so honored to be able to tell these stories and then share them back with the community and have that sort of response.
What do you think is going to happen? I realize, you know, you've done your job. You made the film, you put it out there, mm-hmm. and now it's up to people to respond. But what do you hope they do, mm-hmm. having seen this film? What do you hope changes?
A lot. There's a couple things going on. People aren't aware of the issue, as they should be. Not just in 53206, but across the nation. There's a lot of communities, a lot of people who don't have who aren't familiar with what incarceration is and why it's a problem in our country and the numbers that exist. So I hope this film awakens those people and they get to see how American people are living with incarceration by, you know, the millions. And this is not a unique story. It's a quiet story. But it's a story that needs to have attention brought to it. So to get people talking about it is the first thing, right? Because people just need to know. If people know, they can start getting more engaged. They can start amplifying the ideas, what this is, or just have like an engaged conversation. And then they, you know, that's what change will eventually happen once people start knowing. So that's a process as I see it. Beyond that, you know, I think if this film can galvanize people to organize and to lobby and to educate and to do all those things, that's needed as well. And, you know, this film has a social impact campaign attached to it that will help people have those conversations across the country by using this film as a catalyst, but also additional materials. So I think I would be very happy when this film starts being released on a wide scale and seeing the work that it can generate.
So the conversation isn't over as far as you're concerned, for you personally.
No, I don't think for any of us. The conversation has just begun. I mean, change happens so slowly, and people are now awakening to this issue. So this conversation is going to go on for many years.
One of the comments during the talk back, I think it was from the district attorney, it might have been from the public defender, but one of them said that these conversations are difficult, but we must have them because they're difficult.
Right. Yeah, he's absolutely right. It's going to get hairy. There's a lot of passion, as there should be, on all sorts of angles of this story. It's not a clean story. It's a very complicated story that, like I said, has multiple tentacles to it. So, you know, it's even hard to talk about as just mass incarceration is, like, no one can really see that. No one really knows what that is. It's just a term. But once you start breaking it down and seeing, like, here's an area that we can fix right now. You know, in Wisconsin, there's 3,000 people who are eligible for parole, but are stuck, you know, in the system and can't get out. Yeah, we have mass incarceration, but this is something we can fix, you know, right now. We can do this right now. And that will eliminate at least that small chunk of the big piece of mass incarceration. So, you know, those conversations are needed, and they need to be passionate, vigorous conversations so we can find solutions and we can and we can make things happen. There's not one answer to this, all these things. There are multiple ways we can approach.
Did you ever expect when you set out to be a filmmaker that you were going to spearhead this kind of social change?
No, I didn't, no. You know, my ambitions have always been to be a narrative director, you know, working with scripted material. But I found my way into doing nonfiction content because I just wanted to keep making films. And, you know, oftentimes scripted materials, when I was coming up as a young filmmaker, to do a short film was really expensive. It isn't anymore, you know, but
you can do it on your iPhone.
You can do it on your iPhone now. That's the beauty of the digital, you know, technology. But back when I was, you know, coming up out of film school, you know, film was expensive and I was a poor film student. So in order to keep working, I just started picking up any camera I found and just started telling documentary stories. And I found myself in the social justice world, and I love it, and it's definitely in my DNA. But it wasn't my first love, you know? I found my way into it, and now it's become a first love. And because there's such a need to tell these stories, and having being a filmmaker and a storyteller and seeing and having the consciousness to see what's happening and not tell those stories, you know, there's no way I could not do it. There's no way I could not do it. Doing this story, Milwaukee 53206, it started for me many years ago in 2008 when I went to a correctional facility in New Jersey. And I had never been in a correctional facility before in my life, but I went there to research a documentary I was doing in New Jersey. And there was an event at the correctional facility, and the community leaders came in, and we all gathered into the cafeteria, and they spoke to the men at that facility. And I was just hanging out in the general population. And, you know, I looked around, and all I saw was a sea of black faces, you know, black men who were the same age as me, you know, plus or minus a few years, and who looked just like me, my cousins, my brothers, you know. And that just tore me up. Like, it really sent me to a place where I didn't know what to do with that emotion, because so much of my professional career as a, you know, I work in commercials, I work in, I do TV and documentary stuff. So much of my professional career, I walk into a room and I'm the only black male almost 98% of the time. And there's some black females there, sprinkled, but I'm the only black male most of the time. And so to walk into that room and see that I was a majority in that room, I was sick. I was sick. I was physically sick. And I left the facility not knowing what to do about how I was feeling, but knowing that there was an injustice. And so that sat with me for years because I didn't know have a avenue to get that out. And so when I said it was a no-brainer, when Transform Pictures sat me down, it was a no-brainer.
Is that piece that made you sick, do you feel like that's been eased a little bit?
No. Well, it's still there. It's still there. I feel like it's something that you just kind of have to exercise. And no, you know, just seeing that plenty of people have the numbers, you know the statistics. Black men are incarcerated more than any other, you know, group in the country. You know this. You know the numbers. 1 in 3, you know, black men are incarcerated. You know these numbers intellectually, but to see those firsthand is a different experience, different altogether. By no means is that emotion satisfied. If anything, it's even more intensified because it's just there's just so much to do still. And this film is just a little, you know, notch in that. You know, this film, quite honestly, to tell a full story of a mass incarceration, I would need, you know, a 15-part series at the minimum to go into the depths of the issues here. What can we do? How can we change this? Well, we have to figure it out. We have to take this thing piece by piece apart and attack it, or, you know, talk about it, or whatever we need to do piece by piece, so that, you know, little by little, this thing will change.
So here's your first little piece.
This is a little piece, yeah.
So I'm assuming that there will be more pieces.
We shall see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that you will come back when there are more pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And Keith McWhorter, I want to thank you so much for taking time after a very emotional week here in Milwaukee for talking with us. I so appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Brooklyn-based filmmaker Keith McWhorter conceived and directed the film Milwaukee 53206, A Community Serves Time. The world premiere was at Milwaukee's Oriental Theater in June. You can find out more at WUWM.com.
We will take a short break, but when we come back, we'll hear from filmmaker Kirsten Johnson. Her documentary Camera Person explores what it means to be the person behind the lens. That's coming up next on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Kirsten Johnson has spent a quarter of a century standing behind a camera. As a cinematographer, she's traveled around the world, meeting people and hearing their stories and creating images of their lives. Her recent documentary, Camera Person, puts those images into a different perspective.
The film is an amalgam of unused footage from 24 documentaries she's worked on, along with some personal footage. Johnson spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about her work as a camera person and the purpose of her film.
One of the things that I was interested in revealing is sort of what's around the edges of what we often see in documentaries, and to acknowledge all of the people who are involved in the process and to acknowledge the process itself. But I mean, I think it's interesting that you use those words, curate yourself. Like, I think that is something of a new generation. And certainly in the time when I started filming and in some of the places where I filmed some of the scenes that are in Camera Person, you know, being filmed was not a common thing. It was not something that everybody knew. And now we live in a world where pretty much everyone can be a camera person, and many people all over the world are familiar with what it is to be filmed, see the images they make of themselves, etc. But, you know, I do come from this old school generation of documentarians who existed before the internet and before cell phones gave this ubiquity of imagery everywhere in the world.
Do you feel like now everywhere you go, people know what it means to be on camera?
Well, I think people always have ideas about what it might mean. And I think all of us are wrong in a way, because none of us can know the future. And so we never know what being filmed will mean for the future of our lives or the people who loved us. But I do think we all engage in this sort of promise making around being filmed, you know, and in places where there has been little filming or people's stories haven't been documented, there can be a real hope about what being filmed might mean for changing circumstances, for getting the word out about problems that have never been discussed, that kind of thing, right? But I think we often don't know what the promise is that we're engaging in with people when we film.
I think a lot of interviewers and journalists, they can relate to this film for a lot of reasons. One being, you know, there's a lot of stuff that gets left on the cutting room floor that really humanizes a person, but for whatever reason, you know, just doesn't work in the conversation. I especially felt that way when I was watching the footage you included from Trapped.
Mm.
Why did you include those moments?
For me, there's several things going on in the scene from Trapped, which is a scene in which you see a young woman who's seeking an abortion. She does not want to be identified for many reasons, including her own safety. So I'm just filming her hands. And, you know, one of the things that I've learned over the years of filming is that often people's hands tell a different story than what their voice is telling. And in the scene, Don Porter, who's the director of the film, is saying to her, you know, she's sort of berating herself and saying she feels so terrible and she feels like a bad person. And Don says to her, you cannot call yourself a bad person. And I'm there with Judy Karp, the sound woman. And I think I say something like, you know, you're making us all cry. And we've all had unintended pregnancies. And, you know, my speaking that in that moment, I certainly never imagined that that would be part of Don's film. Because as often is the case with any films that we make, we're not a part of the story, right? In principle. But what we're trying to do as the camera people and the sound people is to give people a space to explore their own emotions and their own perspective on camera. And like you're saying, you as a journalist can relate to camera person, because I think, you know, that's our work, is to create a space of intimacy where people feel like they can speak the things they need to speak. And sometimes those things can be very hard, and it's trying to create a place of empathy. There's no judgmentalism in the way that we're listening, because we're trying to elicit openness.
That was one of the moments that I thought was really challenging, but there are a lot of really challenging moments in the film because people are being open. You know, it reminds me of this sort of classic journalist's dilemma. Do you bear witness or do you do something? And in some ways, I saw you go both ways. For most of us, this is very theoretical, right? But What is it like making that decision in the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the fascinating part about being a camera person. And being a camera person, you are obligated to be incredibly intent in the present. There is so much going on. You don't know what's going to happen. You are the person who's responsible for the technical aspects of managing the camera, of course. But more importantly, you are responsible for where are you in space, allowing the material that you're filming to capture different aspects that can then in the future be cut into a scene that will be a part of a movie whose story you don't know yet. So it's this incredibly sort of active space of the present where oftentimes if I'm really in the zone, I'll feel like I'm watching a movie and I will just be compelled, say, you know, down the hallway as a boxer is coming at me after having lost a match he really wanted to win. Those are the moments where I feel like I'm actually watching a movie as I'm filming it.
Even though you're obviously sort of the person bearing witness, do you also feel like you become a part of their story?
Well, I mean, that's what this very strange thing about camera work is that, you know, the lens takes you deeper into a person than the eye can do. So that you can, you know, with a long lens, you can look deep into someone's eyes in a close-up in a way that you would have to be, you know, sort of standing right up next to them to do in person. And there is a phenomena that happens where I often feel like I'm losing myself in the experience of the person that I'm filming, because I so can feel their physical presence. And yet one of the sequences in the film is me following people, you know, into a mine in Colombia, down a hillside in Myanmar, behind chain prisoners in Missouri. I'm following all these people. I'm as close to being in their footsteps as I can, but I can't walk in their footsteps. And that really is a metaphor for this dissonance one feels as a camera person where, you know, you're filming something and you're like, I am this, but you're not. You're not that person as close as you're trying to get and sort of as successfully as you convey what it is to be them to an audience, you are still not them. And what's going on inside of them is still a mystery to you.
One of the most interesting parts of the film is watching how the shots are set up. You have a number of moments like this where you're filming through a car window, or you see sort of the whole scene and then what you choose to look at. And it goes back to this idea of curation, you know, what's left in the conversation and also what's kept out.
The thing that you're saying, which I find so interesting, is that there's now a generation of people who thinks about self-representation, who thinks about representation and knows that in many ways the representation of individuals can be changed by the way they are filmed, by the light, by the frame, by what's left out, by what's put in. And that's what I really trusted in the making of Camera Person, was the sophistication of the audience and all of us sharing this world in which we have a vocabulary of images, a vocabulary of cinema that allows us to understand how it is constructed. And I do feel like that's part of what I'm really enjoying about Camera Person coming out into the world, is this affirmation that the dilemmas that I face, the ethical quandaries that I struggle with, my laying those bare is starting conversations with audience members who have this really sophisticated understanding of how images function.
There's this one point in the film where you jump from one image to another. And because I was watching it, taking notes, I started writing down the different places, realizing that at a certain point, there were just, I don't know, a dozen maybe images of places and objects that were the cause of a lot of suffering. What was it like shooting these sites, knowing what happened there?
I think because of the career that I've had, I've ended up being in a lot of places where great atrocities have occurred. And there is always an incredible dissonance from sort of what you imagine to what the place is. And you can be in a place like the slave house in Elmina, Ghana, or you can be in Auschwitz, and it is completely different from what you imagined it would be. For one, it's real. It's a real place. And it's very hard to know to what extent you're projecting your knowledge of what happened there on the space or what you can actually feel. And then as a camera person, you know, there I was in churches in Rwanda where there had been, you know, people had been attacked by machete and killed by the thousands, and the blood stains were still on the bricks. The blood stains were still on, you know, the statue of Mary in the church. And you're trying to figure out how in the world can I even begin to imagine what happened here? How can I find a way to film that might translate what it is? You know, one of the themes for me in this film is the sort of inadequacy of my capacity to even approach anywhere near the expression of what the horror has been. But on another level, I feel like one of the things that I've found over the years is how violence remains. So I've filmed 50 years after genocides, 30 years after, 10 years after, 5 years after, 6 months after, sometimes in the middle of. And what's really horrifying in some ways is to realize how long the effects of violence stay. And in some ways, they are in the land, the effects are in people, they reverberate from generation to generation. And so I start camera person sort of with a phrase that says, you know, these images leave me, they've marked me, and they leave me wondering still. And this question of the way in which violence reverberates, I think, is one of the ongoing questions of what I've experienced, of like, how does that function and what is that? I mean, sort of we wonder how violence happens in the first place, and then where does it go?
You talk to a lot of people who have experienced a lot of violence, and you know, you're talking to them about often what are the worst moments in their lives. How does that affect you at the end of the day?
Well, let me just go a slightly different direction from that. I mean, I think that's one of the dilemmas that I face, because that's often what we're asked to do as journalists, is to only speak of the worst moment in people's lives. And there's a scene in the film where, you know, I'm talking with this older woman from Bosnia, and the translator's really encouraging her to speak about what she experienced during the war, and she clearly does not want to. And at a certain point, I kind of can't help myself and interrupt her and ask her about her fabulous fashion sense. And, you know, in many ways, that was sort of out of line on my part as a camera person. But it shows the way in which at certain moments in my career, I sort of couldn't take it anymore, the way in which we as journalists often only look at people as victims, even though, you know, our task is to bear witness to the terrible things that people have experienced. There's a way in which only speaking of people's victimization feels like a way of dehumanizing them on top of the dehumanizing things they have already lived through. So that's one of my struggles as a camera person. But certainly over the course of working on this film, I did come to encounter the way in which doing this work at scale, so taking in many stories of other people's pain and trauma, which is the case of many working professionals like police people, like nurses, like doctors, like teachers, social workers, we all hear many stories that are incredibly painful. And we all feel, I think, that it is obscene in many ways to dwell on the way it affects us, because we're not the people who actually experienced the violence, right? We are the people hearing the tale. But, you know, what I'm interested in is this space in which images actually do mark us as human beings. You know, we say the phrase indelible images, and we all know now that it's having an impact on us to look at violent imagery, that violent imagery can be generative in ways, you know, sort of some of the mass shootings that are happening, some of the terrorist acts that occur, they then generate more. So this sort of question of what we film, what we look at, I feel like is a very alive topic of conversation for all of us on a global level as humans at this moment in history.
Well, Kirsten Johnson, thank you so much for sharing this footage with us. And thanks for coming on Lake Effect.
Oh, it was really a pleasure. Look forward to talking with you more.
Kirsten Johnson is the director, cinematographer, and star of Camera Person, which made several appearances at this year's Milwaukee Film Festival. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in September, and for more information, you can go to WUWM.com.
Another film that showed at the Milwaukee Film Festival gave us insight into the life and work of a noted war photographer, Milwaukee native Dickie Chappelle. We'll learn more about her and speak with a filmmaker next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Last year, we introduced you to John Garofalo, the editor of a collection of photos by the late war photographer and Milwaukee area native Dickie Chappelle. Chappelle was the first U.S. female war correspondent who was killed in action. But before her death in the early days of the Vietnam War, Chappelle lived an extraordinary life, taking distinctive pictures that showed both the cost of war and the personal side of it as well.
Dickie Chappelle is also the subject of a recent documentary. Marianne Lazarski is director and co-producer of the film called Behind the Pearl Earrings. She told Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski how Dickie Chappelle's work first caught her eye.
It's funny because, as mentioned in the documentary, a lot of people never heard of her. And that includes me. I never heard of her until the Milwaukee Press Club was talking about her a couple years back when it was suggested that she be inducted into the Press Club Hall of Fame. And, you know, like many, we're just kind of like, oh, who is this woman? And I heard a little bit about her through that and then kind of forgot about it. And then her name popped up again. I'm a member of the Milwaukee Press Club, and so we were talking about the 50th anniversary of Dickie Chappelle's death, and somebody, I think, with the Milwaukee Press Club President's Council, who had suggested her name for the Hall of Fame, wondered if we were doing anything more with this. And, you know, people were just kind of like, oh, I don't know. And it just kind of kept bugging me, like, well, who is this woman? And so I suggested to our executive producer, maybe there's something here. It seems like she's important, but not a lot of people know about her, and she's local. And that idea kind of went away for a while. And then the Wisconsin Historical Society contacted us because it turns out they were working in tandem with John Garofalo, who's the author of the pictorial book on Dickie Chappelle's work. So it all kind of then started coming back to all of us, and we're like, hey, yeah, this is the woman that I talked about. So long story short, we decided this is great because the Historical Society had so much of her work there. So from a documentarian, you know, point of view, a lot of the research is there. A lot of the materials are there for television. So that's how it took off.
Well, despite being in the Historical Society, why do you think her name kind of fell to the wayside compared to other female war correspondents?
Yeah, that's a good question. No one really seems to know. I think it was timing. You know, timing is everything. And so at the time when she was trying to get started, Margaret Bourg White and Marguerite Higgins, their names were already established and people knew them. So I think she just kind of flew under the radar and just kind of went along, you know, her business, and she was very determined, and she did what she did, but just kind of got lost.
From what I gathered from the documentary, she was very set in what she thought was important work and important reporting. And a lot of the people in the production mentioned, you know, she's very much her own person. Do you think this was viewed as a good or a bad thing as she grew as a person and in her career? Because when she was younger, it's like, no, don't do that. Girls, don't do that.
Right.
But when it comes to being a journalist, you have to be, you know, very good about your own volitions and continue to do your work because it's dangerous situations. So obviously you need a good sense of motivation to be there.
Absolutely. And, you know, as pointed out in the documentary, you know, this was a time when she was growing up, you know, boys were supposed to be boys and girls were supposed to be girls. And as a kid, you know, she was a bit of a tomboy, very smart, and she knew what she wanted to do. You know, mom wanted her to be a writer and an English major and maybe a teacher or whatever, you know, just, but she wanted to be a pilot and she wanted to do her own thing. And she was kind of quirky in the sense that she changed her name several times. You know, she was born Georgette Meyer and then it was G.L. Meyer and then it was Dickie Meyer and all this, you know, so from the very beginning as a young girl, she didn't care that it was the 1930s and the 1940s. She was very determined to do what she wanted to do. And so, again, given that time period, I mean, think about it. Geez, I mean, you had to be that kind of character with that kind of personality to, I think, achieve what she did during that time period. You know, 2016, much different, thank goodness. But back then, you know, you had to be tough.
Yeah, she seemed very rarely disheartened by disapproval from other people. And another thing I found unique about her was her value of being your own person, of being unique, and how that translated into patriotism.
Yeah, she wasn't afraid to say what she believed. I think she showed what she believed even through her storytelling, her photographs, things that she wrote. You know, she wanted to really tell the real stories. She didn't care what the government said or what maybe another reporter was doing. Her goal was to tell the truth. Certainly all journalists should do that. But she really went after those personal stories of soldiers. She really wanted to know about them, you know, their hometown, where they came from, you know, what they were interested in. It was certainly they were, you know, fighting wars, but she really wanted to know a little bit more. And she wanted to get to that, to the front lines, because she knew oftentimes that, you know, reporters were given information that the government wanted to make sure, you know, they tell the stories that will build morale because we're fighting war. But, you know, she really wanted to find out what exactly goes on here. And that's what she did.
What was it like for you as a producer to reach out to the people who knew Dickie personally? And did any of them tell you something that really stuck in your brain but ultimately couldn't get that final production?
Well, the challenge was to find people who were either still around in the Milwaukee area or who were still alive. And we didn't have a big budget. And so that's another challenge, to try to produce a compelling story and get the people, you know, who are important to this. So luckily, we were able to find her stepson. This is Tony Chappelle's son. Through another marriage, she did not have biological children. But he was out in New Mexico and wanted to talk about Dickie. He thought of her as a hero. And when you watch the documentary, you can tell how passionate he is about her and what she stood for and patriotism and what he learned from her. He had a lot of health issues, and so we had to wait patiently to see if we would even be able to interview him. But his wife always reassured me that he's going to be fine. He's going to be fine. And turned out, even when we interviewed him, he was just out of the hospital a short time, still a little weak. But boy, he really, really wanted to talk about Dickie. So that was pretty cool. And I'll never forget his words about why he volunteered to go back to Vietnam.
That was powerful, yeah.
And I was like, wow. He didn't mince words or anything like that. He just told it, you know, the way he felt and just admired her so much. And the other person, I think, who was interesting to talk to and something I'll never forget is Joseph Galloway, who's a veteran journalist and became friends with Dickie. He was a young reporter. He was, you know, in his 20s. I think he was 23, and she was in her 40s. And He learned a lot from her, and he described her, I thought this was kind of funny, as motherly. And Dickey would tell you that, well, she wasn't very much of a homemaker, or, and I don't know if she'd describe herself as motherly, but anyway, Joe was very upset to hear that she was killed, and very honest about his feelings and what he was going through. I mean, he was surrounded by war and, as he said, death and dying. And then he comes to find out that his friend had been killed. And it was quite emotional. So, you know, talking to him and listening to him, and it was a pleasure to meet him, but I'll never forget his description of that day when he found out that she died.
You also used her notebooks for some of the research. What's caught your eye or struck you as you're looking through these handwritten, you know, pieces of history of what was happening in her daily life?
So many notebooks and so many notes that we could only go through so much. But a couple of things that I actually pointed out in the documentary is, you know, you look through her notes, whether, you know, it was covering the Hungarian uprising or World War II or whatever, and notes about soldiers and, you know, where they were from or what was going on. But then all of a sudden you turn the page and there's a grocery list of what she needed to get. Or there's a note to say, don't forget to write to Marm. Marmy was a nickname for her mom. And so those very personal kind of notations that struck me, and that's why I included that. That, you know, she was very human. You know, she was very much focused on what she was covering, but journalists are human and photographers are human, and it's, you know, there it is in black and white. So I thought those two things were kind of interesting.
The very nature of her work being a war correspondent is that you could get killed in action, essentially. And she voiced her wish that if she dies, she wants to be out in the field with the Marines. And ultimately, in the worst sense possible, her wish was fulfilled. And there's that last photograph of her dying on the battlefield, you know, and it's just heartbreaking. And yet that photograph is captured just as she might have captured someone else dying on the field. Do you think, hypothetically, if she could voice her opinion and say what her thoughts came to her if, as she looked at a picture of her dying, that it's important that that photo's captured, that she would have done the same thing?
I think so, because when you look at some of the other photographs, as I mentioned about soldiers that are blood-covered uniforms, and, you know, maybe their face was shot up or something like that, and, you know, some of those other photographs, even with children who are the victims of war, you know, it was reality and it was truth, and sadly it was part of war. So, you know, I thought about that myself, and I thought, geez, what would Dickey do? You know, would she have taken this photograph? I think she would have. I don't think it's something she would have bragged about or anything like that. I think it was just, in the moment, this has happened. And the fact that she was, you know, the first American female reporter killed in combat, certainly very significant, not to take anything away from anybody dying in war, but that historic moment. Yeah, I think she would have taken the picture.
Well, and it strikes you watching it in the documentary, and it's powerful how it kind of closes it out. But much as her war journalist friend said, you know, you're amidst all this dying and you're in the field and working, yet once that barrier gets crossed into that personal touch, like in the documentary show, many of your photographs would show war. But then when you hit that last photo of her, it strikes you in a whole different way. What did you feel when you saw that photo for the first time?
Well, it was the photo, and then it was the video, the film that we have of her actually dying. So certainly the photograph is a very famous photograph, and when I first saw it, you know, it's in black and white, and certainly it's very dramatic. And then when I saw the film, which is in color, we actually had a discussion amongst our production team about, do we use this film? If we do, how do we show it? Do we make it black and white, or do we use it as is in color? And again, it was, why are we doing this? And we thought it was important to show the real deal and what was going on. And so we didn't doctor it at all or change it at all. I think Dickie Chappelle stood for certainly is going after the truth. And so we felt that we did the right thing.
And having that in mind, as well as just who Dickie was as a person and professionally as a pioneer for future female correspondents, did you feel any pressure when you were putting this together, you know, pressure to get it right, pressure to uphold her legacy all within your hour of time? It's hard to
well,
do.
Well, I always want to get anything right, no mm-hmm. matter what I'm working on. That's certainly important. With Dickie, you know, just like her name, you know, you come across several different names. There were several different versions of certain things throughout her life, you know, whether it was her childhood or when, you know, she was with Tony Chappelle, or when she was covering certain conflicts. And, well, okay, this particular article says this. Well, but these other two articles say that. So that's part of the challenge of sifting through your research and figuring out, okay, you know, which source is the most reliable. But there were some discrepancies along the way that I had to question or be careful, and after a while, you know, you go with your gut instinct, your best research. But I think that speaks to her overall kind of quirkiness and individuality that, you know, this the thing about her name, you know, where did Dickie come from? That, you know, that's a very good example. Everything that I read about, people that I talked to, it was, oh, well, she admired Admiral Richard Byrd, and so she changed her name to Dickie. Okay, great. Well, I'm at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and I stumble upon this audio with Mike Wallace, interview with her back in the 60s. And he says to her, where did the name Dickie come from? And she says, oh, that was my grandmother's maiden name, I believe it was. I'm like, huh?
Another thing to check.
Wait, what? And, you know, I checked with family members, and I double-checked articles, and I couldn't get anybody else to confirm that. So I just kind of put it out there and said, well, here it is. Who knows?
Her little secret to keep.
Yeah, probably. Probably.
She probably enjoys it, too. Yeah. Well, Marianne, Behind the Pearl Earrings is a really great documentary, and I wish you the best of luck in the Milwaukee Film Fest screening.
Thanks. It's quite an honor. I'm very humbled to be among hundreds of fabulous films. This is a first for me, and it's quite a thrill, but I'm very humbled and grateful to the Milwaukee Film Festival.
Well, and thank you for being here today, too.
Oh, you're welcome.
Marianne Lazarski directed and co-produced the documentary Behind the Pearl Earrings. It's about the life and work of Milwaukee native Dickie Chappelle. The film was part of this year's Milwaukee Film Festival, and Lazarski spoke with Audrey Nowakowski during the festival in September.
Coming up next, behind the scenes of a Milwaukee-made music video that also made the big screen at the Milwaukee Film Festival. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. We're listening back to some of our favorite film interviews of the past year on today's show. One of the shortest films to show at the Milwaukee Film Festival in 2016 was only a little over 3 minutes long.
It was made by filmmaker and Milwaukee native Caroline Jakes and Milwaukee musician and Lake Effect alum Trapper Shep. The video for his song, Settlin' or Sleepin' Around. It was shot around the east side of Milwaukee. They shared the story of how it came together back in September.
Well, for this video in particular, Trapper had a really clear vision of what he wanted right away. And I feel like with most of his songs, they're so narratively concrete to begin with and structured in a really movie, film-like narrative way, like beginning, middle, end, that I feel like it just came really organically.
I basically emailed Caroline. I said, I have a really crazy vision. Do you think this could happen? And then
I think I may have said no.
25 emails later, we're inching closer and closer to getting the cameras on the street. And it's a very slow process, but it's one that can either take, a couple days or a couple months, depending on how much work you want to put into it and what kind of vision you want to get to.
In general, do you feel like you like it when the content of the song really informs the content of the video? Or you know, do you sort of think of some as more literal and some as more, metaphorical visions for videos?
That's an interesting line for sure, because you don't want to be too on point with what you're doing, but you also don't want to be too far out from the material itself. And I think I write in a way that
leaves a little room for metaphor.
Yeah, but has enough specifics that it makes sense when you're making a music video like the one we made about living on the same street around UWM's campus for 5 years, that when you're workshopping ideas of where to film it, it's not very tough to make the decision.
Yeah. And we had thrown around some ideas. Trapper had a really clear vision that he wanted to have a dichotomy between a young character and an old character. And the old character represents the frame of mind, like, you know, am I still in the right mindset and the right point in my life to still be living on this chaotic campus neighborhood street? Or am I at the point where I want to be moving on? And, you know, we wanted to strategically release it in a, like, either when people were moving in September or moving out in May, and just that transitional period, we try to capture that, the chaotic, you know, people carrying couches around and throwing stuff out. And
carved my initials at the end of this street into a slab of wet concrete. I've been on this.
Musician Trapper Shep and filmmaker Caroline Jakes talking about the music video for the song Settlin' or Sleepin' Around. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.
If these walls could talk.